Let's find a conversation to your soul. Let's conversation to your soul and the
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are very excited to welcome back to the podcast today returning champion Udi Greenberg. And this time we actually haven't invited Udi to talk about Israeli politics. We'll be doing that in the future, but we've invited him to talk about his newly released and excellent scholarly book, The End of the Schism, Catholics, Protestants, and the Remaking of Christian Life in Europe, the 1880s to the 1970s. Udi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the first question is, what made you turn from the émigrés that you studied in your first book, and you took kind of a, examining different émigrés and allowed you to focus on different topics through individual figures to focusing more specifically on religion? Obviously, religion was a theme of your major book, but where did this turn come from, and why particularly this topic?
I think it's a great question. So in my first book, I studied the creation of de-radicalizing and democratizing theories and institutions in post-war Germany. And one thing that stood out to me as an important kind of side theme of the book is that Christianity is a major player in the development of those ideas. Many of the figures I was writing about were either devout Catholic or Protestant. And it's something that I discussed in brief, but my interests were elsewhere. And in the years after I published my first book, there was a large surge in European history of understanding the role of Christianity in the reconstruction of Europe after World War II, that the most important players, politicians, movements, parties that really presided over the reconstruction of Europe after World War II were conservative Christians. And there was a wave of really creative and important scholars who did amazing work for trying to reconstruct that. And I was interested in it because the theme of this large scholarship was really Catholic. Almost all the scholars who worked on it were interested in Catholic lawyers, politicians, activists, churches, and in the role. But having studied Germany myself, which is majority Protestant, I asked myself, where is the Protestant in this story? So after my first book, I looked a little bit at the archives of Protestant organizations, and I thought, oh, maybe I should see what is the story of Protestantism in Europe, which goes through a considerable conversion, moving from the most racist, pro-imperialist, nationalist, authoritarian bloc in many parts of Europe to being on the forefront of democratization. And I thought, that's an interesting shift. So I need to explore that in more detail. What happened as I was working, however, is that I realized that the question that interests me even more is actually, what happens to its relationship to Catholicism? Because all the protagonists and organizations that I was looking at in the early 20th century were virulent anti-Catholics. And suddenly, yeah, after World War II, they become very interested in Catholicism and friends with Catholicism. So that's kind of led me to the question I was exploring.
So just a very basic question for people who might be broadly familiar with the wars of religion. Like, obviously, this is a gigantic question, which could be a 20-episode podcast series. But what is the relationship of Catholics and Protestants in Central and Western Europe?
Yeah, and particularly what is religion by the 19th century? We're not fighting wars of religion anymore in the 19th century, but this rivalry still continues and hostility still continues.
That's a great question. So to my surprise, and I think that that's something that has not been registered in scholarship as much, the story of the relationship between Catholics and Protestants since the War of Religions in the early modern period is not a story of slow decline and fading until they stop mattering. In fact, the reverse is the case. In the middle and late 19th century and early 20th century, there's actually a dramatic increase of animosity between Catholics and Protestants. In many registered in all parts of Europe, Catholic writers and Protestant writers, politicians, organizations, and so on, radically expand the intensity of their animosities. There's a flood of writings in which Catholics and Protestants attribute to each other every illness of modern life, whether it is the rise of capitalism, the rise of socialism, the emergence of feminism. All of it is understood as the product of the other confession. And Protestant attribute to Catholicism being primitive, being dangerous, being subversive, The most famous variation of this is the famous thesis by the sociologist Max Weber, who argued that capitalism emerged from the spirit of Protestantism, which indicated Catholics are primitive and are a hindrance to the modern economy. He's one of hundreds of writers who make this case. Another important theme is that Catholics, because their loyalties to the Pope are actually agents of subversion. Even the Prime Minister of England wrote a book in the 1870s about how Catholics are going to bring down the British Empire and destroy it from within. This is a trope that is increasing in popularity in the 19th century, and often it leads to very real political mobilization. The most notorious example, in Germany in the 1870s and 1880s, the Protestant majority is mobilizing in a campaign against the Catholic majority, leading to the expulsion of Catholic organization, to the shutting down of Catholic schools, for the ending of autonomy in marriage and family law for Catholics, and similar tensions. Fistfights between Catholics and Protestant organizations are everyday occurrence in the Netherlands or in Belgium. In many ways, anti-Catholicism and anti-Protestantism are among the most powerful cultural and political forces of the late 19th, early 20th century. And that is something that crosses national and regional boundaries. And the first chapter of my book tries to reconstruct it to explain why we shouldn't consider the end of this animosity as something that somehow happens by itself, where people just stop thinking about it, but actually it requires a concerted political effort.
So there's a couple of questions that emerge to me if we're just focusing on the 19th century before we get into the heart of the book, which focuses on the 20th century, which is, of course, big things that happen in the late 18th into the 19th century is revolution and Napoleon, but also the 19th century and the historiography of religion is also pointed to as this great moment of secularization. Obviously, you know, Nietzsche's talking about how God is dead, right? You have these dual processes of increased interconfessional animosity and fighting and polemic at the same time as this like great secularizing thing is happening. So what are the causes of this increase in animosity between the confessions?
That's a great question. I think that one of the main things that I was hoping to do with the first draft of the book, and here I'm building on others, is to recognize that this narrative of progressing secularization is incomplete or inaccurate at best. The 19th century is not a story in which religion slowly fades from the European continent. It is true that there are several political projects that are intensely anti-religious and anti-clerical. That is true, especially for the revolutionaries in France and later for the Republicans in France, who are very much anti-clerical and anti-Catholic. Many of them, however, are not necessarily atheist. Many of them include believing Protestants. But most importantly, the process of secularization is really uneven in the 19th century, and it mostly is true for working class people. It is mostly those who identify with socialism and of the industrial proletariat who really leave the churches and adopt a secular form of life. Even there, it's not everyone. You know, especially in the Netherlands, in Germany, and in France, there are huge population of workers who are very devout, and many of them, for that reason, do not join socialist organizations, but they form their own Catholic and Protestant labor unions and parties, and so on. But overwhelmingly, the majority of the population, whether middle class or agrarian, which is the majority of population in Europe at the time, is still very much attached to the idea of Christianity as a guiding light. There are many variations on these. Some are more focused on the church's institutions. Some think about Christianity as more of a general inspiration. But overwhelmingly, Europeans still subscribe to confessional newspapers, confessional organizations. They are members of confessional working unions. So religion and the churches are maybe not as strong as they were in the early modern period, but they are still very much one of the organizing forces of European sociability in the late 19th century. And it is the fact that this sociability of joining more and more civil association, organization, and parties as more and more people become politicized, that so much of this process is done in confessional settings. When you join parties, oftentimes it's a political Catholic party. If you join a reading club, it's oftentimes a Protestant reading club. The fact that socialization is so confessional is one of the reasons that confessional animosities increase in the 19th century instead of being decreased.
And I know your book, before, I know Derek has a question, and I know your book focuses on sort of like the grounded history, but there is a real metaphysics to this as well, right? People believe that when they die, they're going to meet God. So how does that interact with this more grounded focus that you adopt, I think, correctly in the book? But like, there's a theology here as well. So does that inter, I mean, well, I guess we'll talk about that more, but how did the metaphysics play into it?
That's a great question. And that's a question I did not delve into in detail. What was interesting to me is less the obscure theology, even though there are theologians and theological debates in the book, that is not the only focus of the book. What I was interested in is the churches and Christianity, Catholicism versus Protestantism, and something that structured people's everyday life and everyday experiences, and all those churches develop ideas that were not necessarily just about metaphysics or about resurrection, but try to develop answers to very basic questions people have about everyday life. In particular, what sort of economic policies should we support? What sort of state formation should we support? What should be the our way to behave in the gender and sexual sphere? What is the proper gender behavior? All those aspects of life are going through radical transformation in the 19th to the 20th century. And the churches and their affiliated organization are among the most important bodies that provide answers to the question that people have around it. And therefore, the book explores how popular publications about family life, about sex life, are discussed in those publications, how people figure out what kind of economic policies they're going to support when they ask themselves, what is the right Christian way to support it? And one of the points that I was making in the book, and that is especially in the second chapter, is that both the Catholic and Protestant churches and their affiliated organizations offer forms of community and understanding of what is community and what is solidarity and what is stable life in the face of a rapidly changing world, a world of radical economic transformation, urbanization, rising new classes, the decline of old classes. Europeans at the time are going through these very bewildering transformations, and the churches are the ones who provide community and ideas of communities that help people adjust and think about how to live life in those very, very difficult periods. And in my to answer to your question in this regard, I think that that is the most important role that Christianity plays for most believers, European believers at the time, even more than the question of what will happen after death or abstract questions about theology.
The traditional story here, I think, is that this sort of ecumenism kind of emerged in the, is a 20th century phenomenon, right? It's like a post-war, Cold War phenomenon. But in the book, and we can get into chapter two, you really talk about the groundwork being laid in the late, you know, in the 1880s through the 1920s. And it's sort of, it's almost a heartwarming story, really, of these two confessional traditions riven apart and, you know, kind of sniping each other, coming to understand that, no, wait a minute, we both hate women. Like, we both hate homosexuals. We both hate, but it's really around this idea of, like, we both reify the idea of inequality as something to be, this is something that's supposed to be. This is the way God set up the world, right? So, groups, colonized groups should understand their place. Women should understand their place. Like, all of these things kind of cross boundaries between the two branches of Christianity. So talk a bit about how this emerges and how we go from blaming each other for these things, blaming each other for feminism, blaming each other for socialism, to understanding, I guess, that no, actually, we're on the same side here, generally speaking, on a lot of these questions.
I think that's a great question. And perhaps to explain what is the background story for this transformation. So first with the French Revolution, and then again in the late 19th century with the rise of socialism, there are organizations, large political projects that call for total equality, either political or economic, that are simultaneously radically secular. That is true for both French revolutionaries and the later for the socialists, and claim quite explicitly that their idea of equality would be achieved only once Christianity is eradicated as an organizing force for human life. In the case of the French Revolution, that culminates in massive violence against believers and against the church. In the case of socialist there's the trauma of the second French Commune, the effort to establish radical communism in France briefly in 1870, 1871, before it collapses, which also entails the murder of believers. Both those traumatic events lead many believing Christians, Catholic and Protestants alike, to believe that notion of equality is by itself secular and destructive for the church. And from the point of view of historical experience, you can see where it comes from. This, as I argue in the second chapter, leads both Catholics and Protestants to come to claim that inequality, whether economic, whether gender, whether international, relationship between Europeans and non-Europeans, in order to have basis for spiritual life that is stable and in which people live in harmony and without violence, they have to accept inequality as the basic basis, category, and foundation for life. And their efforts in all those spheres, in legislation about economics, in legislation about politics, about gender, is to enshrine inequality into European life from the belief that that is the only precondition for virtuous life. That means that they mobilize together against socialism, trying to create anti-socialist labor unions, anti-socialist welfare policies. They mobilize into crafting anti-sex reform and anti-feminist policies, arguing that the family and the inequality between men and women is the precondition for human solidarity and flourishing. And those ideas that are really flourishing in the late 19th century will be the basis for Christian politics or mainstream Christian politics and thought for the rest, for the following century. But this recognition that there is some overlap between Catholics and Protestant thinking and belief in the in inequality leads to very hesitant cooperation in the late 19th and early century. The Catholic, as I said, Catholic and Protestant labor unions mobilized together against socialist labor unions. Catholic and Protestant parties together write legislation that would enshrine patriarchal rule, that will make sure that women do not have the same right of men, that men have authority over children that women do not, that restrict same-sex relationships even more so than before. Those are forms of kind of hesitant practical cooperation between Catholics and Protestants that they believe will create a condition for virtuous life. This does not mean that in the late 19th and early 20th century, Catholic and Protestants view each other as brothers or believe that there's some deep similarity. At that stage, it's mostly practical cooperation against enemies. But that is the genesis of the story.
The shared belief in inequality is the scaffolding on which you will build.
Exactly.
That is my question. So is it a subtle argument of the book that religion, at least as historically extant, is a conservative force?
Because this is a big question. That is a great question, and we can get back to it later. But throughout this period, there are always exceptions. There are always those who are mobilizing in support of socialism, who support some version of feminism. And later in the book, I talk about radical feminists and Christian who mobilized towards third world liberation in the 1960s and 70s and in support of anti-racism and radical feminism and radical anti-authoritarianism redistribution. There are always exceptions. But historically, in the 19th and most of the 20th century in Europe, the Christian churches and their affiliate organizations largely develop ideas that we would associate with conservatism.
Why? Is it because they own a lot of property? Is it because they're part of the traditional power structure?
I'm not a Marxist. I don't believe that private property will be the explanation for all of this. As I said, I think that they have very clear historical experiences that would lead them to believe that demands for equality will mean the destruction of the churches and the destruction of virtuous life. That is the French Revolution and the French Commune, and socialism as it evolves in the late 19th century is radically anti-religious and secular. And from the point of view of the churches, that is an existential threat. And they have good reasons to believe that this is an existential threat. Does not mean that we need to endorse their ideas.
No, of course. But the problem is with modernity, right? So ultimately.
Correct. I mean, they see the relentless demand for equality is something that plausibly is a threat to spirituality as such, because it's so obsessed with material explanation of the world, with obsession with economic distribution at the expense of communities that leads to atomization, instead of solidarity that is based on selflessness. Those are the ideas that inform Christian thinking.
So just one question before we move on to the 30s. Counterfactually, if the revolution wasn't so anti-clerical, could things have been different? Or was the revolution inherently going to be anti-clerical because it's trying to basically move past the social structures of France in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries?
That's a great question that should be directed at scholars of the French Revolution in particular. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of contingency. The French Revolution at first is not that so vehemently anti-religious. Many Catholic participants in the French Revolution and see it as potentially liberating. There is a radicalization of the revolution that takes place in later years, especially after the conditions of international war, that leads to the radicalization, including to the anti-clerical turn that he takes. That is true also for the socialist. I mean, that is, we don't know what conditions would have looked like, whether the move against the churches and Christian life would have taken place if socialism would have been more successful and more accommodated in the late 19th century, maybe. But the truth is that history turned the way it did. And I've tried to explain, I think as someone who grew up outside the churches and outside the orbit of the churches, trying to give a sympathetic, at the same time critical, understanding of Christianity. And to, I think it's very easy for readers who live outside the orbit of the churches to think that Christianity is somewhat stable, that there are ideas that are always true for it. And what I try to show in the book is that there are some principles that repeat themselves, but they are constantly negotiated and change, and they respond to very specific historical events, experiences that inform how people think about what it means to be Christian.
So, Udi, before we get into the 1930s and where I really think the book starts to dig at the traditional narrative about how Catholics and Protestants came to put aside their differences, maybe it would be helpful to talk about that traditional narrative, which is, you know, comforting and happy and I think intentionally false, because it obfuscates a lot of what you talk about in the book. So maybe it would be good to kind of lay out what is the story that the churches tell about themselves, and then we can get into what happens in the 30s and start to contrast these things.
That's a great question. So traditionally, to the extent that people studied it, the story of when and why do Catholic and Protestants give up their initial animosity and come to embrace each other in a project that they call ecumenism, a project of mutual embrace, the story focuses very much on the experience of the 1940s of World War II and the immediate post-war moment, the notion that both Catholics and Protestants, like many other Europeans, came to see the experience of Nazism and total war and fascism as deeply traumatizing, came to believe that the instability, the animosities, the tribalism of the 1930s and 40s led to unimagined catastrophe, and that it's out of the mutual suffering under the hands of fascism that ultimately Catholics and Protestants put aside their differences and embrace pluralism. That is the broad history of European Christianity as told by Christians since the 1950s onward. The story that I tell is a bit less comforting and begins a bit earlier. The story that I tell begin in the 1930s, and what I find is that it's the project of mutual embrace between Catholics and Protestants as an intellectual project was very much rooted by the rise of Nazism and especially fascination with Nazism. Today, when we think about the Nazis, we think about its intense racism, its genocide, and its war. But in its early years as a movement, first of all, it spoke very much languages that echoed and borrowed Christian discussions of inequality, the notion that employers and workers should live each other with each other in harmony, but accept inequality, that men and women have different roles. All of that the Nazis said, and quite explicitly said, we are in alliance with Christian teachings on this matter. What the Nazis also say that is new, however, is that Catholics and Protestants are one because they are equal members of a unified racial body that is against communism and against Jews and against other groups. In the founding manifesto of the Nazi Party, the so-called 25 points that is written in 1919, Article 24 says we believe in a concept that they call positive Christianity. It says we don't think there's substantial difference between Protestants and Catholics. Both are fine and both are part of the German body. This is a radically new idea that the Nazis popularize. At first, when they're a small party, no one pays attention to them. But once they come to hegemony, first in Germany and then over Europe, there's a move of multiple Christians to pay attention and to emulate it. The first Christians, Catholic and Protestants, who explicitly say Catholic and Protestants are one and together in one body, are those who are sympathetic to Nazism. Catholic writers who say we should learn from the Nazis, Catholicism, Nazism, Protestantism, everyone is together under the same roof in its fight against godless atheism, communism, against feminism. Many of those texts are also explicitly anti-Semitic. So that is, in my book, I try to trace the many, many figures that in the 1930s and 1930s develop a new language of pan-Christian solidarity that are very explicitly say this is part of our effort to also build bridges between Christianity and fascism.
So I think this necessarily leads to the question is, where did the Nazis develop this idea? Correct me if I'm wrong, but famously, a lot of the Nazi elite is Catholic. The party's first real center is in Bavaria, the Catholic part of Germany. Hitler himself was Catholic. So where does that idea come from? I mean, obviously, there's this new racial ideology percolating in the 19th and 20th centuries, and that is sort of a higher truth above religion. But like, where did the Nazis get this?
That's a great question. So early in the 20th century, when the first racial theorists and movements, political movements, circulate in Europe, the operating assumption, and it's common, is that Catholics and Protestants are separate races. That is a notion that you find in several publications. The famous German historian Heinrich Reitschke, in the late 19th century, when he writes about the difference between Catholicism and Protestantism, he says, if you look at the body movement of Catholic people, you can see that they just move differently. It's clear that Protestant and Catholics have different racial origin. And this is not a fringe idea. Many others emulate it. The Nazis really introduce a new concept, and that is part of their revolutionary theory that is very much post-World War I in response to communism, to the Bolshevik Revolution, which argues that diversity is good as long as it is within the confines of racial unity. And the project of racial unity is supposed to bridge all the different polarizing differences, factors in the German body. So, for example, say the difference between regions, between Bavaria and Prussia, is ultimately marginal. We recognize that there is a difference, but it is within one confine of the racial body. The difference between classes, between workers and employers, is there, and we respect it, but it is ultimately need to be subjected to the racial unity of the nation. The unity between Catholics and Protestants is part of this project of trying to create a new body that is at the same time diverse and have internal diversity, but ultimately is subjected to the unity of the racial body and racial unity against external enemies and domestic enemies. This is the revolutionary idea that is very much through the racism.
And so how do the official churches, I mean, there's one official Catholic church and there's many different official Protestant churches, but broadly speaking, how do the churches respond to Nazism before we get into the more progressive response to the Nazis?
There's a variety of responses. Even inside the Catholic Church, there are many factions. You know, we have sometimes a misguided vision of the Catholic Church as an hierarchical organization in which the Pope or Bishop say stuff and everybody follows. That's not the case. Overwhelmingly, lay people have their own debates and own writings, and oftentimes they ignore the orders, the instructions of clerics, or sometimes they use them very selectively for their own purposes. That is even more true for the Protestants. And there's a vast scholarship that tried to trace how Catholics and Protestants responded to the Nazis, and there's a diversity of responses. Some are hugely enthusiastic about the Nazis. Some are very interested in it, but have serious misgivings about some policies. The Nazis, for example, as the regime matures and becomes more confident, begin to encourage premarital sex and begin to encourage sex outside of the family in a way that is deeply alarming for Christians. And some from the get-go are deeply hostile to it. And there's wide variety of responses to the Nazi message, and especially their internal debates about Nazi take about conversion. So, for example, if you convert to Christianity from Judaism, from the Nazi point of view, you're still Jewish. For some of the churches, it's really important that conversion should be respected and you will not be considered Jewish. So there are internal debates around this question also. So there's a wide variety of responses. I think historians overwhelmingly agree that in Germany, the majority of Christians, with some reservations, embrace a Nazi regime out of the hope that it will achieve goals that they care about, like defeating feminism and defeating communism, and that they have different levels of investment in or reservations about the regime.
There is an anti-fascist Christian element here, though, right? So what is the reaction from those folks to the Nazis? Like, how can we talk? How do we,
That's a great question. So there is a groups of thinkers and activists that consider Nazism to be a version of communism, something that is obsessed with race and with blood, and that ultimately evacuates spirituality from its centrality in human life. And many argue quite explicitly that this obsession with race means that family, that solidarity, that love, that selflessness are meaningless, and therefore Christianity should reject Nazi racism. What is interesting to me, and what I try to trace in the book, is that beginning in 1935-36, those anti-fascists also begin to speak about deep similarity between Catholics and Protestants, that in many ways, as they observe the huge popularity that the ecumenical idea seems to have among Nazi sympathizers, also anti-fascist in Germany, in Switzerland, in Austria, in France, also begin to say the fight against racist heresy and against totalitarianism is a struggle in which Catholics and Protestants are united. And they argue we need to understand that our first allies in this struggle is the other confession. And they develop a new theological language for this, new economic theories for that. So what we see here is that with the rising dominance of Nazism, the language of ecumenism and the idea that Catholics and Protestants are one is so popular and so dominant and so pervasive that also anti-fascist no longer can ignore it. They have to appropriate it and develop their own anti-fascist language as they try to develop a language that is anti-fascist to mobilize believers against the regime.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more with volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
So let's move to the post-war era. One of the ironies that your book, of course, traces is that the moment that people point to as the origins of this ecumenism is actually in the Nazi regime, but it does continue into the post-war period. So do you find yourself agreeing with the traditional story that has been told that in the shadow of the Third Reich, everyone is just like, we can't do this any longer and we need to come together and there's humanism? Or what is the different story that you're telling? And of course, this might be a useful place to at least introduce the United States, which was very crucial in supporting Christian democracy across Europe. And you might want to also identify what is Christian democracy and how does that function in the early Cold War in particular?
That's a great question. So what happens after the war is that almost everywhere, Christians mobilize, find their new parties, which they call Christian Democrats, that mobilize, manage to capture the vote of the European right, which until then was fractured between multiple factions, fascist, non-fascist, conservative, monarchist, so on, all under the banner of Christian democracy, and come to be the most dominant political force alongside socialism for the following decades. And in the case of West Germany, Italy, Netherlands, Belgium, France, either the most important political force in Reconstruction or a very important partner in the process of Reconstruction. On in all those countries, it is Christians that build those political parties are the dominant force. All of them tellingly, however, are non-confessional and explicitly say, we are a multi-confessional, inter-confessional parties. That is true in Germany, where Catholics and Protestants come together in the foundation of a Christian Democratic Union, but it is also happening in a place where demographically Protestants don't matter in particular. Let's say in France, where Protestants are less than 2% of the population. Nevertheless, Christian Democrats say we are no longer partisan of Catholicism, and we accept and put Protestants in prominent positions. This is a departure from Catholic politics of the 1920s or earlier period, where Protestants were not members of Catholic parties. What happened is that in all those organizations, interconfessionalism is the center of the discourse and of political organization. What is new, however, as I said, is not the fact that that Catholics and Protestants work together. This conceptual innovation already happened in the 1930s and 1940s. What is the innovation is that Catholic and Protestants across different political axes are now willing to cooperate together. So those who earlier were pro-fascist and those who earlier were anti-fascist put aside their difference, completely ignore this event as if it never happened, this debate. It's hardly discussed. Almost no one makes reference to the very bitter debates between pro-fascists and anti-fascists, and all of them agree to cooperate because all of them agree that this is an opportunity. Reconstruction is an opportunity for Catholic and Protestant to put into practice, to enshrine in European politics, the principles they have been hoping for ever since the 19th century. That is, building an economic system that kind of takes care of the hard edges of capitalism through welfare policies, but makes sure that that workers and employers are not equal and are explicitly against policies that are explicitly against equality and are articulated as policies that are against equality. Similarly, policies when it comes to family life that are premised on the inequality between men and women, enshrining patriarchal rules and patriarchal principles of inequality between men and women. Those ideas are now that Catholics and Protestants are working together, they are able to implement the desires and visions that they had since the 19th century. From their point of view, World War II confirms their belief that a world without Christianity is a world that leads to destruction and death. From their point of view, fascism turned out to be, even those who supported it claim that ultimately fascism has shown itself to be an anti-Christian organization principle that is focused only on race instead of natural and peaceful inequality. And therefore, they feel vindicated and argue that only Christianity could defend Europe from falling apart again to another war and another fascist experiment.
Christianity can't fail. It can only be failed, basically.
So true.
Yeah, the operating assumption is that Christianity was always right and will continue to be right. That is, of course, the narrative is filled with myopia. It's filled with ignoring the flirtation and support for fascism among many Christians. It is filled with intentional suppression of the very virulent anti-Semitism that early ecumenists expressed. Now, after World War II, it's just not discussed. Oftentimes, the most virulent anti-Semites republish text and just omit all the parts where they mention the Jews. You can find it in multiple examples. But to me, that fact is, I think, known to historians. What for me was interesting is less the obvious myopia, which is to be expected, but this myopia is also what it offers is not only self-serving stories about greatness and, you know, moral purity, but it is also something that offers a way to go beyond the internal conflict that has divided the Christian world around the question of support or opposition to fascism and allows anti-fascist and pro-fascist to put aside their differences and come together in forging kind of a grand compromise and a grand alliance that for the first time allows Christians to have dominance of political life and to shape Europe in the way that they envision for a couple of decades.
So I've got a few questions that emerge from this. The first one is, to what degree does the fact that Europe is now mostly Judenrein actually shape this? That sort of the Jew as a cultural figure has been largely eliminated from Europe. Does that allow this ecumenism to happen? Is it just unrelated?
I think that's a good question, but you know, it was never the presence of actual European Jews in the continent that explain anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, you know, makes reference to the Jews, but it is a cultural, political imagination that could have easily continued to operate after World War II, even after there are far, far fewer Jews in Europe. I think the taboo Nazism is so associated with anti-Semitism, and especially American hegemony is constantly pointing to the role of the Jewish minority as kind of the test on which people's inclusiveness and openness to pluralism is measured, makes it so that open, virulent anti-Semitism cannot be expressed in public in the same way as it did before. Doesn't mean that people suddenly abandon anti-Semitism, of course, in private. It's likely that it continue to flourish, but it can no longer function as the unifying political cultural code that it played for much of the European right up to that point. But the point that I was making is that ecumenism, the cooperation between Catholic and Protestants, started long before the Holocaust, and it was openly anti-Semitic, and it continued to flourish even after anti-Semitism as a formal doctrine is no longer an important force or formal open force in European
thought. And then, of course, you need the role of the United States, because the United States, from my understanding of this diplomatic history, is really wants to support Christian democracy. That they're not, obviously, they're not stoked on communists. And though there are some people who are really interested in the non-communist left, that's certainly not everyone. So how does the U.S. play in here?
That's a great question. And I think that goes to the broader question, what is the role of the United States in Europe's reconstruction about after World War II? And there's an intense debate among historians around this question. I'm of the camp to think that the United States should be understood like most empires. It is something that sets the confines under which local actors operate, but it is the local actors with their own ideas and their own agendas that have been created long before the Americans arrive, who ultimately decide what the content of Christian democracy is. So the Americans, yes, they provide, you know, ink and paper and money for Christian publications. In the case of Italy, in the election, they really put their thumb on the scale and tried to fund Christian organizations that led to the triumph of Christian democracy electorally. But ultimately, Christian democracy likely, I think, would have flourished without the United States, because Christian democracy emerged as the political force that unified the European right. And the European right was almost everywhere stronger than the European left. It doesn't mean that European socialists were not strong and not important forces, but in the continent, Christian democracy is kind of an autonomous force that takes advantage of the arrival of the United States, but does not need the United States to reach its dominance. It reaches it with electoral success that is based on local traditions. This also relates to specifically the question of the role of Judaism in this story. As some readers or listeners might be familiar, during World War II, the concept of Judeo-Christianity becomes very popular in the United States. Suddenly, many writers talk about Judeo-Christianity. Politicians begin to talk about suddenly this new combination that Jews and Christians are part of a unity, and that the United States is part of this tradition of Judeo-Christianity. There's a new idea that begins to circulate in the 1940s and is very popular in the United States in the 1950s. I see almost no trace of it in Europe. So Christian Democrats they share the anti-communism of Americans. They hardly read American publications. They are not interested in American theologians or writings. You will find very little references to or citations to Reinhold Niebuhr or other prominent American theologians and writers at the time. And the concept of Judeo-Christianity is almost completely absent from the Christian discourse in Europe. So all of this is to say that American influence is important as a geopolitical presence, but intellectually, politically, I think when it comes to Christian democracy and the story of Catholic-Protestant cooperation, American influence is actually fairly marginal.
One thing that's going on in this period that challenges this shared reverence for hierarchy and inequality is, of course, decolonization. So talk a little bit about how decolonial movements and how resistance movements in the colonies, Gandhi, for example, I know you mentioned in the book, is not well regarded by a lot of these folks. But talk about how that affects this process.
Thank you for asking this. This brings an element that kind of runs through the book, which is the role of missionary projects of international politics. So Christian missionaries, Christian organizations are deeply indebted to European imperialism. They believe that the capacity to propagate the gospel and to bring it to the people of Africa and Asia is deeply tied to the dominance of European empires. That is true since the 19th century and throughout. Missionaries, which are really important Christian actors, and the writings are widely read at home too, and shapes how many believers understand the colonial world. Missionaries are very much the last to jump on the ecumenical train. Throughout the 1930s and 1940s, there's hardly any cooperation between Catholic and Protestant missionaries. Even as at home in Europe, people begin to talk about the deep similarity of Catholics and Protestants, you'll find almost none of it in the missionary world. However, with the beginning of decolonization, the collapse of the imperial state, anxieties about the survival of Christianity in the global South begin to spark the ecumenical turn also among missionary and Christian activists and organizations in Africa and in Asia, especially the experience of the communist revolution in China, which one of its first action in 1951 was to expel all missionaries, Catholic and Protestants, from the most populated country in the world. And later, it seems like in Africa, many other countries seem for a moment like they're going to follow the footsteps of the communist revolution and also expel missionaries from their territories and take over the educational system that the missionaries have established since the imperial period. That moment, this anxiety about the collapse of imperialism is what, in the book, I argue is the final catalyst that led the missionaries, well, the last one in the world to come to the ecumenical conversation, to jump on this train and to say that actually Catholic and Protestants should unite if we are going to survive in this new and hostile world after empire. And that means that for the first time in the 1960s, after the collapse of imperialism, we see joint conferences of Catholic and Protestants, new missionary organizations begin to work together, they find new organization, new initiatives, and that kind of makes ecumenism the mainstream, not only in Europe, but also in the colonial world. And that is a somewhat, I would say, very bittersweet story, or kind of grim story, if you'd like, which means that Catholic and Protestant, instead of coming together to celebrate the liberation of the Afro-Asian world, as far as I could say, come for it for the exact opposite, out of deep, deep anxieties that are understandable about the end of European imperialism.
So let's move on to the 60s and the 70s. How does ecumenism proceed as the kind of the early to mid 20th century generation fades from the scene and a new generation begins to take power in the churches in particular?
Yeah, so the last chapter, which is the one that probably required for me to start really from scratch the most, is not a lot written about it. I tried to reconstruct the rise of a new generation of Catholic and Protestant activists, thinkers, and politicians who are always in the minority, who are very influenced by the ideology and the vision of the new left, of radical anti-authoritarianism, anti-imperialism, grassroots activist-led socialism and feminism, and try to revolutionize Christianity. And that requires immense intellectual ingenuity because you have to write against a century of Christian thinking and politics to argue that Christianity actually does not support order and inequality, but support disorder and equality, that argues that praying to God as a presiding father that supervises us is in fact authoritarianism, and the way we should think about Christianity as a community based in which God and humans all pray together in a union between equals. And there's a wave of especially students, but also older writers who try to devise new languages and new organization that would support radical Marxism, that would support radical feminism that would support gay rights and the decriminalization of same-sex relationships. And a branch of this is also supporting 1960s and 1970s radical anti-imperialism that sends money to guerrilla organizations that fight the Portuguese Empire in Angola, and so on. So this is a massive break from everything that Christian mainstream has been for since the 19th century. What I found interesting, and there's been almost nothing written about that, is that all of those actors, activists, politicians, theologians, writers, all argue, the one thing that they take from the generation before them, argue that the basis for this rebellion is cooperation between Catholics and Protestants. And they all try to argue why Catholics and Protestants together are the natural allies in this global uprising against Western imperialism and authoritarianism and the patriarchy. And that, to me, is the end of the story, because it shows how ecumenism have become so normalized and so second nature for so many Christians that even those who seek to completely overthrow everything that came before them, the one thing that they preserve is the belief that Catholics and Protestants have some deep structural alliance and similarity between them.
So just to bring back to one of my first questions, do you think this is at least partially a project of secularization that I think it's pretty undeniable did occur over the course of the 20th century? Are these essentially rearguard movements that there is a decreasing, at least in the North Atlantic world, there's a decreasing religiosity as far as I can tell. And so that this was kind of a coming together that was necessary when there is a genuine process of secularization shaping societies. Plus, there's as everyone's bowling alone, quote unquote, or I don't know what they do in Germany, beer hauling alone, or whatever it may be, so that you need these things to come together.
Yodeling something, yeah. Yodeling alone.
Sorry,
that is a great German question. Listeners.
Yeah. And
I think again here, one has to speak against what is oftentimes considered to be like common knowledge and is just wrong. Secularization is not a process of slow decline and kind of gradual progression. That is not the case. In fact, in the 1950s, religiosity reaches a new height. More people pour into churches, more people pour into religious organizations. Religious symbols and language are more present than ever in the 1950s. The story of European secularization, and here sociologists have mapped that, is really a story of sudden and surprising collapse in the 1970s. Suddenly in the late 60s, but especially in the 1970s, do we have a world in which Christianity suddenly collapsed? People just stop going to religious events. They stop registering in religious organization. They don't read religious publications. We can really measure it because we can tell when religious magazines just stop publishing because they don't have the subscription to sustain it. That's in the late 1960s and early 1970s, when all the major think tanks, many of them just go bankrupt and start operating. That is not something that slowly happens, but something that happened suddenly in the 1970s. So the stories that I'm telling of a century of European Christianity is not a story of Christian slowly trying to respond to kind of a slow but persistent erosion of Christianity. That is not the case. The story of ecumenism is a story in which Christians are at the height of their influence in the late 19th and early 20th century. And the story comes to conclusion exactly as Christianity begins to lose its significance for at least Central and Western Europe. And that's in part the reason why I think the story is worthwhile telling, because it is not a story of niche organization. It's not a story of fringe organization that don't matter for Europeans. Huge masses of Europeans affiliate with the churches and live within the orbit of Christian organization with varying degree of interest and investment. But it is only in the 1970s that we can really say, okay, the Christian churches become really marginal players in the same way that, I don't know, labor unions become marginal players in European life.
So, Udi, there are a couple of things that I wanted to ask that are sort of tangential to the book, but related. One thing the book does focus sort of on Central and kind of Northern Europe, but you talk a little bit about how these processes played out geographically and sort of, you know, taking a longer time in Southern Europe. And maybe we could talk a little bit about why that is. And then somewhat related to that, I'm curious whether there's a story to tell here about what's happening with the Orthodox churches at the same time that, that the Catholics and Protestants are learning to get along with each other.
That's a great question. And I think that I will answer it in two parts. So to the question about the geographical confines, the story that I'm telling is really a story of Central Western Europe. It's a story of Germany, Austria, Switzerland, France, Belgium, Netherlands is the center. The main reason for that is that this is where we can see why both the hostilities between the two confessions and the end of between them is not, there's nothing natural about those. Because if you compare it to what happened in Southern Europe or in Northern Europe, you realize that in all those countries, there's a different dynamics in play. In Southern Europe, in Italy and in Spain, discrimination against Protestants survives into the 1950s and into the 1960s. In the 1950s, in democratic Italy, it is illegal for Protestants from other countries to operate as missionaries. In Spain, restrictions are even harsher. Protestants are discriminated against as a minority. They're not allowed to have public services. There's very draconian restriction on how you are allowed to worship in Protestant services. All while in Central Europe, ecumenism is flourishing. The same is true for Northern Europe. In Northern Europe, which are Protestant majority, there are legal discrimination against Catholics in place in the 1950s and 1960s in funding for schools, in the limitations on operation of Catholic organizations. All of those, in terms of the process of secularization, our demographics are more or less going at the same time with Central and Western Europe. But the process of relationship between Catholics and Protestants is very different. And I think that by pointing to those differences, we can see that we really need to understand ecumenism as an ideological project that relies on specific historical experiences of those countries. In particular, all those countries come under Nazi hegemony, and all of them experience the rise of pro-fascist and anti-fascist Christianity at the same time. So that is one to the question of geography. To the question of the Orthodox churches, I decided not to include the question of the relationship with the Orthodox churches for a reason. The reason is that the relationship between Catholic, Protestant, and the Orthodox churches is really a relationship that is between church authorities, between church diplomats, that is at the level of theology and church officials. There are hardly any Orthodox communities that matter politically in France, in Belgium, in Germany. But the project of Catholic-Protestant reconciliation is not a project of state officials. It is driven by lay people, by writers, by church, by politicians, by people who often explicitly ignore orders that come from Rome. The Vatican, for example, in 1948, explicitly said no cooperation between Catholic and Protestant is permissible. In most of those countries, people politely nod and then just proceed to ignore it. One of the themes that informed the project is that we need to understand Christianity not as something that stems from church officials, but is something that is really driven by lay people, by believers who have their own agenda and their own ideas. Sometimes they overlap with church officials, but oftentimes not so. So the story of the Orthodox churches and the relationship to European churches is in this regard thematically very, very different.
Well, thank you, Udi, and thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, check out his book, The End of the Schism, Catholics, Protestants, and the Remaking of Christian Life in Europe, 1880s and 1970s, for all of your religious history needs. And Udi, we look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks for joining us, man.
Thank you so much for having me.